Within the past several years, the field of aesthetics and cosmetic dermatology has witnessed a significant increase in both the demand for and availability of non-invasive procedures and treatment options for soft tissue augmentation. In this dialogue, Dr. Jane Y. Hu and Dr. Heidi Waldorf discuss the modern approach to soft tissue augmentation.
This is Dr. Jane Yu for Dialogues in Dermatology, and today I'll be interviewing Dr. Heidi Waldorf. Dr. Heidi Waldorf is Director of Laser and Cosmetic Dermatology at the Mount Sinai Medical Center and Associate Clinical Professor in the Department of Dermatology at the Icahn School of Medicine of Mount Sinai University. She is an internationally respected expert in the field of non-invasive skin rejuvenation, including the use of injectable fillers, neuromodulators, cosmeceuticals, lasers, and other devices. In addition to her practice at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City, Dr. Waldorf also sees patients at her private practice, Waldorf Dermatology and Laser Associates in Nanuet, New York. Welcome, Dr. Waldorf.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I'd like to ask you a couple of questions, if you don't mind. How has the landscape changed during the past decade with regard to the aesthetic viewpoint and patients' expectations and their demands?
I would say that the major difference in the last decade or even two decades since I began to practice is the availability of more products and procedures to allow us to non-invasively rejuvenate the aging or photoaging face and body. As we've gotten more products and procedures for this, patient expectations for quick fixes have certainly risen. The style of rejuvenation has also changed. In the past, patients expected to reach a certain age and then do a major overhaul via an eye lift, a facelift, and other surgical procedures. Now patients expect to start gradually tweaking or improving themselves, starting as young as their late 20s into their 30s. So none of these changes are as dramatic, but they maintain their youthful appearance longer.
Now, there are currently a lot of fillers that are available at our disposal. Can you please tell us about the different kinds that are currently FDA approved?
The fillers that are FDA approved in the United States can be split between hyaluronic acids, calcium hydroxylapatite, and polylactic acid as the temporary fillers, and Artifil, which is a permanent filler that is FDA approved. Silicone is not FDA approved as a permanent filler or for any purpose in the skin, but since it's FDA approved for use in the eye, it is also available. The primary fillers that are used in the U.S. can be split into hyaluronic acids and calcium hydroxylapatite, which are standard fillers. In other words, you put them in the skin and you see improvement immediately, and then as they gradually go away, you get some stimulation of collagen. So the patient is still going to be better off afterwards than they were before. The other category is biostimulatory. And in the biostimulatory category, we have polylactic acid or Sculptra, which is in essence a medication that we dilute and inject to stimulate the skin's ability to make collagen and therefore fill the area. So those are the two major categories. I generally stick to those categories, which are the temporary fillers. The major difference between the old days is that all of these fillers last at least 6 months and even up to 2 years. When I started in practice in 95, we had collagen, and Zyderm, and after that Cosmoderm, and Zyplast and Cosmoplast lasted at most 6 months, but for most people 2 to 3 months. Those fillers are no longer available, but having these new fillers with this longer lasting yet still temporary duration has really changed the entire way that we utilize fillers.
I see. So thank you so much for that differentiation. It seems like we've gone a long way for the past decade. Now, soft tissue augmentation is much as a science as it is an art. What are some of the properties that differentiate the fillers that can guide or aid you in soft tissue augmentation?
If you think of it in terms of layman's terms, we want fillers that are going to be long-lasting yet not permanent, give significant lift where we need lift, give softness and moldability where we want that, and that are very tolerable to the patient, both in terms of our ability to inject them as well as the post-procedure time course. In terms of the rheologic definitions, or the definitions that are define the properties of these, we're talking about G prime, or elasticity, plasticity, cohesivity, as well as hydrophilic nature. We initially felt that any filler with a high G prime would, by definition, give us more lift. A high G prime meant that that filler could stand up against gravity. The gravity of our walking around, as well as the pressure put on it by our musculature and movement. However, we now have fillers that have lower elasticity, but still give a lot of lift. And that's led to the realization that properties like cohesivity or the dermal integration, as well as plasticity, the ability of a gel to be shaped and formed, really must be evaluated in addition to G prime when you're looking at a given product. In general, a product that has a higher G prime is stiffer. But if it has too high a G prime, that means you may get lumps and bumps. But if it's too low a G prime, there's no support. If you have a high G prime product that doesn't have plasticity or the ability of that gel to be shaped and formed, we won't be able to use it in an aesthetically pleasing way. We also want products that have the ability to integrate into the dermis if we're using them superficially to reduce their visibility in the dermis. Finally, when we're looking at hydrophilic nature, that's going to both aid in some of the appearance of fullness, but can also increase the downtime a patient exhibits after injection. If a product is very hydrophilic, it's going to cause more swelling after injection. Patients don't like swelling. However, some of that extra moisture that's brought in can also improve the quality and appearance of the skin and aid in the longevity of the product. None of these properties should be evaluated on their own. You have to have a mix of all of them when you're evaluating.
So it seems like we can't rely on G prime by itself. Now, are there considerations that you have to make with individuals of different facial shapes or various cultural backgrounds, perhaps even considering males versus females in your augmentation technique?
I like to look at soft tissue augmentation in terms of the art, the science, as well as the economics for every patient, male or female, and of every ethnicity. First, the art. We know that there are standard shapes that are universal across cultures for both men and women that show beauty and are perceived as youthfulness. For women, it's generally the heart-shaped face. Think of every Disney character. All of the Disney princesses have heart-shaped faces. Or an upside-down egg. Look at someone like Catherine Deneuve, who has a longer face, but has a tapered lower face relative to the upper face. For men, we're looking at more rhomboidal shapes. You want to make sure that a man retains his square jaw. He has a very straight line at the temples, as opposed to a line that is curving up to the forehead. In terms of all of these shapes, we are trying to keep a youthful triangle. When we think of the youthful triangle, we're thinking of the aspect where we look at the eyes first. Studies of beauty have shown that everybody looks at the eyes first. So you want to make sure that the patient's eyes pop. In a youthful face, a triangle is inverted. It is wider at the top and goes down to the chin in any of these face shapes I've mentioned. As we age, that triangle turns over, and the wider part is at the bottom, making us look sad, making us look long and drawn. So we try to flip that. If we've done our job well. When the patient walks back in to our office, they look well rested and they look more awake, alert, and attractive to us. This artfulness has to be applied to each patient individually. None of us are completely symmetric, although symmetry is considered beautiful. So as we treat patients, we want to make sure that we are not aggravating any asymmetries. We can keep their unique personal asymmetries, but not make them more so. So if somebody likes the fact that their upper lip is much larger than their lower lip, you can keep it that way, but don't make it more prominent, or else you'll start having people look cartoonish. The science we have to think about when we're thinking about these things is the actual anatomy of people's faces and how they age. We lose bone, we lose fat, and we lose dentition in a very standardized fashion. Part of what we're doing is not to make people look unlike a normal person, but just replenish those areas like the jawline or the deep mid-face fat that we've lost as a part of natural aging. Finally, the economics. Any of us can make someone look good with an unending amount of filler. It's very important when you approach a patient that you discuss with that patient their long-term goals and their financial ability to support this. We can't have patients with expectations of having one syringe of a product giving the facelift. So that's something you have to consider also. Again, it's the art, the science, and the economics must all be factored in as physicians when dealing with a patient.
Those are some important points that you bring up. Dr. Waldorf, now, do you have some favorite injection techniques that you would like to share? I know that you're a huge proponent of using cannulas. Where and when do you use these?
First, it's important that we recognize that it is not the filler, it is not the cannula, it is the person using it. So there, in any area where I use a cannula, I have colleagues who use needles and they come out with beautiful results. For me, I appreciate using a cannula in areas where I feel it will reduce bruising and swelling, or it adds to safety, or both. For me, cannulas are my go-to tools for the temples and for the mid-face. For the mid-face, I'm often going deeply into the deep mid-face fat as well as up into the tear trough. With the blunt tip cannula, I can start laterally on the face where there's fewer blood vessels, make one injection point, and then glide my cannula in a fanning technique to spread out my filler throughout that area. I'm less likely to go through another vessel, I'm less likely to cause bruising that way, and I'm adding to safety by reducing intravascular compression. For the temple, similarly, I can use a cannula by injecting further down and laterally, where perhaps I can better avoid a superficial vein that might cause the patient to have a black eye, and then spread it throughout that area and even go backwards into the hairline to provide lift. My patients find that it tends to be more comfortable because I'm anesthetizing the one point of injection. However, I never promise that patients will avoid a bruise completely, because anytime we make any puncture into the skin, you can bruise. On the lower face, personally, I prefer using needles. I find that in men in the beard area, the skin tends to be tougher. In patients who have had prior surgery, such as facelifts, they are more likely to have scar tissue in those areas, and it becomes more difficult for me to place my cannula where I'd like it. Regardless of the technique I'm using to get the product into the skin, most of my injections are deep. I inject subcutaneously and superperiosteally wherever possible. By doing that, I find I am improving longevity and reducing the risk of visible lumps or bumps.
I think you touched upon this, but as we know, with any dermatologic procedure, complications may arise. Do you have any recommendations for dermatologists to avoid such complications and items they should stock in their office if they are so unlucky to encounter them?
The easiest thing you can do to try to avoid complications is to prep the patient's skin well. Too often, I see colleagues and trainees starting to do injectables without having prepped the patient's skin. We should never be injecting through makeup or through sunscreen. When my patients come in, they're told to wash their face, then my assistants wash the patient's face again, and then right before I start, I clean the face with chlorhexidine and then alcohol. And I do that until I see that there is no makeup, no debris on my wiping pad. That way I can assure a clean technique, just as I would for a punch biopsy or any other superficial surgical procedure. Another important point is to make sure you ask the patient about recent dental work. You do not want to inject any filler that's going to be implanted into the skin in anyone who's had a recent dental abscess or infection. I also ask patients not to go to the dentist for some period after the injectable is done because of the risk of bacteremia, even during a tooth cleaning. If you do see the patient with a hot, red, angry bump after injection, it's important to rule out a biofilm. Remember that biofilms are infections, but there is so little of bacteria in that biofilm that you are unlikely to get a culture. Make sure you give the patient an appropriate antibiotic for broad spectrum coverage, and don't automatically inject with steroids. I will sometimes inject with 5-fluorouracil, both to reduce inflammation as well as for its ability to act as an antibacterial agent. In addition, I may give patients some oral steroids or a topical anti-inflammatory like Protopic to use to reduce that inflammation. And I inject hyaluronidase. By injecting hyaluronidase, you can reduce the nidus for that infection. Most importantly, if you get necrosis, an impending necrosis, if you see a white blanch or a patient calls saying that they have significant pain outside the area that you've injected or telangiectasia going along what would be the pathway of a vessel, bring that patient back immediately. It's critical that you train your staff not to just tell people to use ice when they call complaining of bruising or pain. Give them a checklist so that they can triage appropriately and bring these patients in. You must make sure that you have hyaluronidase to remove any hyaluronic acid if you've injected that. Have nitro paste to vasodilate the area. And have your patients stop using ice and instead use warm compresses for the area. If you have an actual necrosis, you can consider other techniques, including getting the patient into hyperbaric oxygen chamber.
Now, sometimes patients come into your office wanting to look like certain celebrities or certain performers. How do you deal with those patients whose expectations you may not be able to realistically fulfill?
In my practice, more than having people bring in celebrities, photos, who they want to look like, frankly, they come in saying they don't want to look like certain celebrities who've been overdone. I discuss with my patients getting a natural look. And I will say no to them. If a patient comes in wanting lip augmentation, but the rest of their face needs volume, I will not do the lip augmentation until I have volumized their face so that the lips will look natural in the context of that face. There are some people who will walk away, but for most of the patients who you take the time to discuss that with, you will have a patient for life. It's also important to recognize that you cannot give everybody the look they are wanting within the context of soft tissue augmentation. Someone with thin lips cannot have thick lips without advancement surgery from their mucosa. And we need to be freely honest with our patients and let them know that.
When a patient who has had a complication from another practitioner comes into your office, what do you do?
The first thing to find out is what they had injected. I'm always shocked by the number of people who have no idea what has been injected. It's critical that you not inject over an unknown product. You can easily stimulate a granulomatous reaction if you inject over silicone or one of the other temporary products. I always discuss with patients that I can only do what's necessary and what I can do given what I'm seeing. Unfortunately, those patients often take a long time. It is always harder to fix something that you haven't started than to fix something else. But this is medicine and we have to take care of these people.
And finally, Dr. Waldorf, if you had a magic crystal ball, what would you anticipate seeing in the coming horizon?
There are several new fillers that are either undergoing FDA tests currently or will be. Most of those fillers will have only subtle differences to what we do now and may or may not add in an important way to our armamentarium, but we will have more fillers available. I'm hopeful that we will also have some of the non-cross-linked hyaluronic acids that we can then use in other parts of the body. Currently, we're really limited in terms of fillers on the neck and the décolletage, and that's really our next horizon.
Thank you so much for spending time with us today.
In the early 1980s, bovine collagen products were one of the first FDA-approved fillers made available to dermatologists for the treatment of photoaging and aging skin. These bovine-derived products usually required skin testing prior to use due to risks of delayed type hypersensitivity. In addition, they tended to only last 1 to 3 months in duration. The search for filler products with low antigenicity and longer duration led to the development of a wide variety of dermal fillers that are now currently available. With this new armamentarium of dermal fillers that we now have at our disposal, Dr. Waldorf stressed the importance of utilizing science, art, and economics as a modern approach to treating our aesthetic patients. Understanding the science between the aging and photodamaged face is an important aspect of mastering soft tissue augmentation. There are different changes that occur to the face that change the anatomy, texture, and overall structural support over time. As we age, there is increased bony resorption, fat atrophy, collagen loss, and skin laxity. Overall volume loss also leads to increased laxity of suspensory ligaments in the face. These changes are coupled with cumulative UV photodamage that may cause more prominent wrinkles, creases, and grooves, most notably on the face. Once these changes are accurately diagnosed, interventions may be made to restore soft tissue volume loss by choosing the most appropriate dermal filler for specific problem areas. Fillers can be broadly characterized into two main categories, permanent and temporary dermal fillers. Artifil is currently the only FDA-approved permanent dermal filler made available in the United States. It is comprised of bovine collagen polymethyl methacrylate microspheres, which are non-absorbable once injected into the skin. However, temporary fillers are absorbable and ultimately are degraded by the body. They usually last at least 6 months to 2 years depending on the type and composition of the product. The main FDA-approved temporary fillers are composed of calcium hydroxyapatite, or RADS, poly-L-lactic acid, or Sculptra, and hyaluronic acid, HA fillers, are available in a wide variety of formulations such as Restylane, Perlane, Juvederm, Prevail Silk, and Elevest. Hyaluronic acid and calcium hydroxyapatite fillers are the most commonly used within the United States. When choosing a filler product, there are different properties to consider, such as G-prime, plasticity, cohesiveness, and hydrophilic nature that lend to their respective uses in various settings. The G-prime is a measure of elasticity. Plasticity correlates to the ability to be molded or shaped. Cohesiveness is the ability to be integrated seamlessly into the dermis, and hydrophilic nature relates to the propensity towards swelling. Specifically in HA fillers, the degree of cross-linking correlates to a lower G-prime and the ability of the product to withstand enzymatic degradation, therefore making certain HA fillers more long-lasting than others. These properties collectively define the profile of specific fillers. For example, Bellatero, an FDA-approved HA filler, may be more appropriate for the treatment of fine lines and lip enhancement than Perlane, which tends to be more viscous. The art of soft tissue augmentation is often associated with experience, comfort level, and refined injection technique. Additionally, Dr. Waldorf also recommends understanding the different cultural and gender differences that define standards of beauty and youthfulness to help determine where augmentation may be most beneficial. Overall, heart-shaped faces are more desirable in women compared to more rhombic shapes with square jaws in men. There are also individual characteristics that make a patient unique, such as certain facial asymmetries. Finally, the economics of soft tissue augmentation is also a very key concept. It is important to balance the patient's long-term goals with associated costs to do so. Achieving this equilibrium may involve resetting expectations away from quick fixes, employing a more gradual treatment plan, or employing adjuvant therapies to enhance effects of filler and maximize benefits to achieve the best natural look for our aesthetic patients. I hope you enjoyed this edition of Dialogues in Dermatology. Next month, we look forward to three new dialogues on women's dermatologic issues. Remember to join us on Facebook for previews, educational info, and collegial fun. This has been Terry Cronin with Dialogues in Dermatology. Stay passionate about dermatology and keep up all the great work you're doing on behalf of your patients. Have a happy holidays and another great month.